Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast is the discussion portion of Who Protects the Worker, part of Volume 8 of the 10-part public television series Free to Choose. Milton Friedman is joined by other guests at the University of Chicago to discuss some of the ideas presented in the documentary segment and last week's podcast of Who Protects the Worker. Listen now, and don't forget to subscribe to get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
Well, we tried a free market system without labor unions. We tried it back in the 1920s and into the 30s, and it led the world into the biggest economic disaster it's ever seen in modern times. Now, I don't think we're talking free market or labor unions. We're talking free market with or without labor unions. And a free market system without labor unions is a total disaster.
Let's get other reactions to this now around the group. It's the free market system, Milton Friedman's been arguing, I think, not labor unions, which best protect the interests and serve the interests of the worker. Walter Williams, your reaction.
Well, I think clearly labor unions serve the best interests of workers who happen to be members of labor unions at the expense of workers who are excluded from being members of labor unions.
Ernest Green?
I don't think you can have a democratic society without having trade unions. I think if you look at any democratic country, it's essential to it. Right of workers to organize, and I think it's consistent. If we are to maintain a democratic country, those freedoms that the right of workers to organize is a primary objective that we have to maintain.
Bill Brady?
Well, if they are so vital, why are so many union members leaving the union? Why are they losing so many decertification? Why are the unions losing so many decertification elections? Why has the number of union members declined so precipitously from 23% of the labor force to, what is it now, less than 19, 18%?
Well, it depends whose figures you're reading, but workers aren't leaving the labor movement in droves, and the union is not declining precipitously. My union, the United Steelworkers of America, the major unions in the country, many small ones are out organizing and growing. The mix of work in the society is changing. We have some employers, as we saw in the film, who can't wait to rush off to the South and try to get in an anti-union environment and invest their money in prosperity in the South instead of in the North. And surely if you invest money anywhere, you're going to have prosperity. We also have a mix in terms of civil service and service workers, where we have employers who have grumbled on that film.
I don't know that if you invest money anywhere that you're going to have prosperity. I don't think that that's a given. That is, you seem to me to be dealing in a premise there that is incorrect.
But well,
The key question we're discussing is who protects the worker? Is it the labor union or the free market that best serves his interest?
Well, it seems like from the evidence that I have from a number of research projects that I've engaged in, I found that labor unions protect their members often at the expense of disadvantaged people. And it's a very, very interesting question that labor unions down through the ages have discriminated against all kinds of people in favor of a particular class of workers. We find that labor unions have gone out on strikes and have murdered and maimed people because other people sought entry. And in terms of Mr. Green's remark, he says that in a free democratic society, we need labor unions. Yes, that is true. We need the right for voluntary association. That is, people have the right to form associations, but it should not be a requirement that you be a member of a labor union in order to establish a contract for employment.
Can't we get some perspective in this, Walter? Talking about unions down through the ages makes no sense at all in terms of where we're at now in this century at this time. This business of trying to relate where unions come from to the medical profession and hypocritical oaths, however one looks at that, back in the Greek islands really has very little relevance.
Yes, it does.
The violence, hear me out a minute, I waited patiently.
Okay.
The violence it's associated with, well, not so patiently, but I waited. The violence associated with the labor movement and so on has been minimal and was a reaction in this century, not over the ages, a reaction in this century to the violence done workers by corporations and powerful economic groups when there was no workers' organization to protect them, and no way to deal with their greed and with their power.
Now I'm turning to Milton because he's heard the flavor of the discussion.
Sure, what Lynn Williams now is saying is utter nonsense. There's no two ways about it. The conditions of the worker in this country before there were labor unions were very important, improved very greatly. You cannot tell me that millions of people, my parents, your parents for all I know, parents of many people around, came to this country from Europe in order to be exploited and in order to be subjected to violence. Of course, there were incidents.
I disagree with that vehemently. I mean, most of the blacks came to this country not voluntarily, but they were shipped here.
And the interesting thing about the issue on Spartanburg, is that you left out.
Let it finish, and then back to you, for sure.
The blacks are an exception, and I agree with you completely.
22 million exceptions, though.
They are a very important exception, but there are also millions and millions. The people that Mr. Williams represents are not mostly black. They are mostly from the Slavic countries that came from Eastern Europe.
If you look at the membership of the steelworkers,
if we go back, there was violence, of course. There always has been violence. It's not excusable. I'm not excusing violence on the part of anybody. But I agree with Mr. Green and with Walter Williams that people should be free to organize. Of course they should be free to organize. What I object to is the special privileges that have been given by government to labor unions, which are not available to other groups at all. When labor unions have used violence in industrial disputes, they are not subjected to the same sanctions as people ordinarily are. When cars are turned over in the course of a labor dispute, how often do people go to jail as a result of it?
Dr. Friedman and Walter Williams go back in history, and they take a look at a situation where America was empty, where we didn't have anything like the sophisticated industrial economy we have today, but had a much more agricultural and rural kind of economy. And of course, when the impoverished peasants of Europe, my ancestors and most of our ancestors, except for the slaves, which is another situation, but when these people came from Europe and came to a wide open continent with the most fertile soil then available to anyone in the world, naturally there was progress. And I or any of us would be mad to deny progress. But as that developed, and as population increased and as we moved into a much more sophisticated industrial economy, we moved then into the situation in the 1930s. Or earlier than that, at the end of the century, as some of the more skilled jobs came along, the labor movement didn't happen by accident, didn't happen because there wasn't a need there. The results of this development, even with all the wealth available in America, the results of this development was that many working people were not having anything like, by standards of civilization or whatever, anything like their fair share in this progress.
Now, you're arguing that in a free market for labor, everyone benefits. Does that mean that you would favor abolition of all immigration restrictions?
The situation of immigration restrictions really has to do with the question of a welfare state, as I say in the film. I would favor completely free immigration in a society which does not have a welfare system. With a welfare system of the kind we have, you have the problem that people immigrate in order to get welfare, not in order to get employment. You know, it's a very interesting thing. If you had asked anybody, before 1914, the U.S. had no immigration restrictions whatsoever. I'm exaggerating a little bit. There were some immigration restrictions on Orientals, but it was essentially mainly free. If you ask anybody, any American economic historian, was that a good thing for America? Everybody will say, yes, it was a wonderful thing for America that we had free immigration. If you ask anybody today, should we have free immigration today, almost everybody will say no. What's the difference? I think there's only one difference, and that is that when we had free immigration, it was immigration for jobs in which everybody benefited. The people who were already here benefited because they got complementary workers, workers who could work with them, make their productivity better, enable them to develop and use the resources of the country better. But today, if you have a system under which you have essentially a governmental guarantee of relief in case of distress, you have a very, very real problem.
This is true of every Western industrialized country.
And that's why today, under current circumstances, you cannot, unfortunately, have free immigration. Not because there's anything wrong with free immigration, but because we have other policies which make it impossible to adopt free immigration.
Well, I'd like to other reactions. Is it at all feasible to open the door of the labor market internationally now? Bill Brady?
I would say yes, providing they open the door to us. I think that the door to not only the labor market, the door to all markets should be open, that is, product markets.
My feelings about the undocumented workers of Mexican-Americans are inscribed at the foot of the Statue of Liberty. I think that people should have the right to come to this country. Now, those who would say, I hear a number of people saying that Well, the immigrants are contributing to our unemployment problem. And I pointed this out to some people. I said, look, you know, this is the same rhetoric that the Irish use when the blacks are coming up from the north. You know, they're using blacks as scapegoats. They're saying, get those people back where they came from so that our members can get jobs, you know. Unions were as well doing this. You know, they call them scabs, strike breakers, et cetera, et cetera. So I do not wish for Mexican-Americans to become the new scapegoats of our particular national problems. They are not the problem. And our nation benefits to the extent that these people come here and work. And to that extent, so it's kind of good for them to remain illegal aliens as opposed to being legal aliens where they're subject to our welfare program so that we don't want them to come here to work.
I think that this country cannot have a group of workers to remain outside the framework of our laws and our protections. And as long as we have workers who are attracted to the United States because of the standard of living, and I think minimum wages pay a part in that. As part of that attraction. But it seems to me to have undocumented workers without providing either a means of protection for them, and it seems to me we've got to go to a question of providing the amnesty for those generations of workers who have come here over a period of time, now 2, 3, maybe 4 generations. We have to see that they have the same rights and protection of all other workers. And as it stands now, large numbers of them live outside the framework of the laws and statutes that we have on our books.
They do. And the tragedy of the situation is what Walter Williams points out, that as long as they are undocumented and illegal, they are a clear net gain. The nation benefits and they benefit. They wouldn't be here if they didn't. The tragedy is that we've adopted all these other policies so that if we convert them into legal residents, it's no longer clear that we benefit. They may benefit, but it's no longer clear that we do. What Lynn Williams said before is again a travesty on what was actually going on. The real boost to the trade union movement came after the Great Depression of the 1930s. That Great Depression was not a failure of capitalism. It was not a failure of the private market system, as we've pointed out in another one of the programs in this series. It was a failure of government. It was not the case that somehow or other there was a decline in the conditions of the working class that produced a great surge of unionism. On the contrary, unions have never accounted for more than one out of four or 1 out of 5 of American workers. The American worker benefited not out of unions. He benefited in spite of unions. He benefited because there was greater opportunity, because there were people who were willing to invest their money, because there was an opportunity for people to work, to save, to invest. That's still the case today. You say we have to provide him with something or other, Ernest. Who are the we?
We the people.
But how do we the people
do it? Seems we the people provide them the protection by seeing that their safety.
You're talking about the immigrant population.
And occupational health codes that protect the environment that they work in. See that they have civil rights laws that protect their own person. See that they have civil liberties laws that protect them further. We the people of this country provide that protection.
It's so bad. If they don't have, you know, you're kind of paying an image. You know, why are these people coming? We're not pulling them here by chance.
It's obvious why people come here.
Gentlemen, don't all talk at once.
So what are you talking about protecting them?
Why did you leave Little Rock, Arkansas to go to Philadelphia?
It seems to me that it's obvious why.
Would you extend the courtesy to finish? Look. First thing, let me say the following thing, because there's some basic things that you need to know.
Well, I'm going to say the thing I was interrupting. I'm going to say five more things. There isn't all afternoon.
That, you know, labor unions and minimum wages, for that case, cannot improve the condition of the working people of a country.
We do it every
day. Because if
we can improve the condition of working people in countries all around the world,
you know what this man,
every day.
You know what you're telling the audience? You're saying that you can solve the problems in Bangladesh. You can make them a rich country if you tell them to unionize like we are and demand higher wages.
No, I didn't say anything remotely like that.
No, it's productivity that keeps income low.
I come back to my initial question. Why are so many leaving the union?
There aren't very many.
Oh, there are too.
I've given you the statistics. You think you've rhymed off some percentages. I live in the labor movement.
Do you have other percentages?
It's true.
And of course they pay me, of course. Right. And I don't have any objection to that at
Neither
all.
Neither do I.
At least we got you a few minutes ago. We got you to get the labor movement up into this century. And I agree with the observation you made. That the industrial union movement, that there was a union movement, came out of the dirty 30s and out of the depression and grew, and that was essentially an industrial union movement. But I wonder if, I wonder when I hear your commentary on the film and so on about unions and restricting practices and restricting access to industry and all of this, I don't mean it disrespectfully, but I really
don't mind being disrespectful. That's all right. I'm used to it.
I really wonder if you do understand how the industrial union movement, which is the more recent part of the movement, how it really operates. We're not telling anybody who they have to hire. We're not doing anything.
Let's raise the question, which certainly is dealt with in the film. Yeah. Have minimum wages, which is a form of government intervention, serve the interests of the poor and indeed of the working class generally? Now, I know you've spent a good deal of time looking at this. I'd like you to come in on it, too.
Okay, well, at least from the standpoint of teenagers, particularly minority teenagers, the minimum wage law has acted to destroy a number of employment opportunities. For example, back in 1948, the black youth between 16 and 18 had an unemployment rate of 9.4%, and white youth was 10.4%, 10.2%. The labor force participation rates of blacks was considerably higher than that of whites. And with each increase in the minimum wage law, we had the dramatic reversal that we have now. And so the minimum wage law has the effects of saying that if you cannot produce $2.90 worth of goods an hour, you don't deserve a job.
Well, and I don't think you can't look just at minimum wage. You've got to look at the relocation of firms. You've got to look at the movement of people. You can't do that.
Well, you look at relocation of firms. A lot of people try to say a lot of jobs move out to the suburbs. Well, you find black-white unemployment ratios the same in the suburbs as you find in the cities. So it's minimum wage.
You're taking one element of a long historic development.
And
when
even if
you're
Lynn is next.
Ernest Green. Come on now.
I understand the law. Educational
Lynn,
achievement.
And then Ernest
you
Green.
You get a differential between black and white.
I'll bang the gavel. Come on, Lynn.
Well, you're taking one element years ago in a situation that's entirely different than we're in today and drawing some conclusions.
That's what's the difference.
No, there are many other things that are different. The enormous movement of black people in this country between 1948 and now, you can't just wipe that out. And you certainly can't say that's the minimum wage.
But,
that has an enormous amount.
I want this case made. Has the minimum wage served the interests of the working people of this country?
I don't think there's any question. I don't think there's any question that the working people of this country would be much worse off than they are today. The youth of this country would be much worse off than they are today if we didn't have minimum wage.
Okay, now Bill Brady,
it's a bad idea. It is patently one of the worst things that we can do to our youth. We prevent them
What's that? How many kids do you have?
I have two.
It's not important how many people.
Well, but it is. Minimum wage doesn't affect his industry. His wages are far above the minimum wage.
Minimum wage doesn't affect a single one of his members.
Hold it. Milton has the floor.
We have not gone to support minimum wage legislation in this country.
Gentlemen, hold it a moment. Hold it a moment. Hold a moment now.
Of course we have not.
Lynn,
people's organization.
The chairman has said the floor is Milton's.
I was saying that there's not a single one, I suspect, of the members of your union who is affected by the minimum wage rate. They're much higher. You say that you are a public service organization.
I say we're a people's organization.
You're an organization of your workers, and if you aren't representing the interests of your workers, they ought to fire you.
And we're out.
If you tell us that you are going against the interests of your workers, then you are simultaneously saying to your workers,
This is pure sophistry.
I am not talking
about representing the interests of our workers. Our union represents a lot of people.
Right.
And some of the people are the ones that you're probably aware of, the people who work in big steel mills and all the rest of it.
Absolutely.
But we also go out and organize workers all the time and win certification votes, despite Bill Brady's comment about that. And many of the workers we organize are workers who are affected by minimum wage. The result of our organizing them is we're able to bring them above the minimum wage.
The point is that I think that both these gentlemen, we all should recognize, is that unions in the United States support the minimum wage. They're the major supporters, and they spend millions and millions of dollars in lobbying for the minimum wage law.
They do it out of the name of concern
and being in the interest of people. Now, in South Africa, the unions are far more honest. That is, those white racist unions over there, they say we support minimum wages and equal pay for equal work so as to protect white jobs. That is to protect white jaws from low price competition.
But are you not implying that we're white racist unions?
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that it doesn't make any difference about the intent.
Walter, the effects are independent of intent. The Urban League supports minimum wage. Ben Hooks of the NAACP supports minimum wage.
The floor blocks are
the reason support minimum wage.
Why?
They represent middle class blacks.
No.
They don't represent the poor blacks on the street.
The membership of the NAACP probably.
And they're owned by the AFL-CIO.
They aren't owned by the AFL-CIO.
Order. Chairman says order. I'm going to turn to Milton now. Are you saying then that you would advocate the repeal of minimum wage legislation?
Of course.
You would?
Yeah. Of course I would.
Bill Brady.
I should like to ask Ernest and Lynn why they want to restrict a minimum price to labor. Why don't you let me have a minimum price on the products that we manufacture?
Well, we aren't here, as I understand it, to discuss your problems at the moment in terms of the owners.
Is there a difference? Why
you're the people I assume are so anxious to have the free market system and to compete with each other and all the rest of it. We're talking about the needs of the workers. We're talking about the needs of the people who come into a society which isn't providing enough employment for them, which clearly doesn't seem to be able to provide enough employment for them, and what are we going to do? And I think this notion that somehow if we just let every guy who's running a hamburg stand or whatever, we just let all these people exploit the young people of this nation in any way they chose, pay them any little rate they could get away with, that everybody would then to go to work, everybody then have a job is absolute nonsense.
I want to bring Milton to one of the final stages of his film, which is on Spartanburg, South Carolina. Sure. And I want to know what conclusion you're drawing from that. Would you, in effect, like to see the whole of the United States become, as it were, Spartanburg writ large?
Absolutely.
Yeah. What would that mean? And then we'll get their reaction to it.
It would mean a widening of the opportunity for everybody. It would mean an opportunity for employers all over to compete with one another for workers. It would mean an opportunity for workers to find jobs which can make the greatest use of their own skills and their own capacities. It would mean that consumers would be able to get better products at lower prices. You know, consumers enter into this situation too. You might think that somehow or other, you know, one of the things that's always a mystery to me, if a $2.90 minimum wage benefits people, why wouldn't a $6 minimum wage be better? Wouldn't a $10 minimum wage be better? Why don't these people come out for a $200 a year minimum wage? If all you had to do is to make a country
proud. $200 a year is pretty small.
$200 a day, an hour.
Or extended to babysitters.
Yeah, if all you need to improve the lot of the conditions of people is to legislate a higher workforce.
No, you're back on minimum wages. I want to know how Spartanburg would
get large. Spartanburg improves matters because it introduces a wider range of competition. And the real thing that protects a worker is the existence of alternative employers seeking his services, just as what protects a consumer is alternative sellers.
Milton, you omit one thing that it would do, and it would result in a very substantial increase in capital investment.
Absolutely, it would.
And capital is the worker's second best friend.
Sure.
This is only to say that a busy economy, one in which there's investment and development and so on, is an economy that's a good economy for working people and for everyone else. I think we say that in the AFL-CIO at least once a month, all the time. There's nothing in which we're more interested than having a busy, functioning economy. The question is how to bring that about. I do suggest, and I think would can be defended as long as we want to discuss it, that the prosperity we have in America today, that the labor movement has made an enormous contribution to that, and in the absence of the labor movement and in the absence of minimum wage, this would not be as prosperous a country as it is.
Now, hold it
that
there.
Is not to
hold
say
it there,
that it's
Lynn.
Perfect.
I want to get a reaction to that. He stated the case for what the union has achieved. Could we go around, first of all? Do you accept any part of that?
Yeah, it's preposterous. You know, as I suggested before, I mean, if minimum wages can make people richer.
So unions we're talking about.
Well,
now.
If unions can make people richer, all you have to do is tell people in Bangladesh, why don't you unionize and demand a higher wage? You can be rich like the United States.
We're telling them
it's productivity.
In the world. We told them in Japan.
No, workers have higher wages in our country because they're more productive. That's how you get higher wages. And this is just plain, it's nonsense.
And why are they more productive?
Huh? Because they have capital.
Enormous capital investment.
Another, right.
Yeah, and the highest wages are paid in the higher, the capital intensive industry.
And because there are consumers to buy the stuff who have wages which enable them to go into the marketplace and buy something.
Without the capital investment, they wouldn't have the wages. There would be no way of paying them without the capital investment.
Ernest Green, what's the reply?
I stand by my initial statement that it is a prerequisite of a democratic society to have trade unions, organizations allowing workers to band together in their mutual interests. And if that group, I'm saying that trade unions like A. Philip Randolph, Sleeping Car Porters, the Pullman Car Company would have never on its own given those workers who worked very hard, were very productive people, well-educated, any increase in their wages had it not been for the intervention of Randolph.
The crucial issue is whether governmental measures which have the effect of favoring union organization, of giving them privileges and immunities that are not accorded to other organizations in the society, benefit the society as a whole or harm the society as a whole. The proposition I tried to make in this film was that the source of the prosperity of this country was freedom of enterprise, freedom of employers to hire, of workers to work for whom they wanted to, that insofar as unions had played a role, they had protected some workers at the expense of others and had retarded the prosperity of this country. I think that Lynn Williams' statements to the contrary cannot be supported by any empirical or other evidence, that he has, understandably, I'm not blaming him for this, he would be faithless to his job if he did not believe sincerely in what he's saying. I'm not questioning his sincerity, but sincerity is a much overrated virtue in our society. The plain fact is that there is no evidence whatsoever that either unions or minimum wages have made positive contributions to the prosperity of this country. Some unions have, of course. Some unions have done great harm. It's not an open and shut picture in which you can make a sweeping statement. But on the whole, the growth of this country...
Make a sweeping statement.
I do. The sweeping statement I make is that the prosperity of this country derives primarily from freedom of enterprise and freedom to hire, to employ, to work, and not from restrictive measures imposed by trade unions.
Everybody briefly now.
And I would say that the intervention of a strong federal government, who those employers hire, the kinds of protection, the wage standards, health conditions, are the requirement of this government to protect its people, because the history of it has shown that that hasn't occurred. And in your case in Spartanburg, South Carolina, again, I argue that the only reason that they can come back now and attract firms from Switzerland and Germany is because, one, that we had a strong government that provided protection for all of its citizens, which didn't occur 15 years
ago. Brady?
Economic freedom, in my opinion, should not be a bridge. I think that these two gentlemen are advocating that it be a bridge. They're advocating a retention of the minimum wage. They're advocating, I think, that Lynn Williams is advocating a retention of the Davis-Bacon Act. They do not, it seems to me, believe that freedoms are interdependent and indivisible. There are freedoms, there's economic freedom, there's press freedom, there's freedom of assembly, there's religious freedom. And you are advocating, to me, a great abridgment of economic freedom. And when you do that, you injure the other freedoms that we have. And if you do it enough, as we are doing in this country today, if you do it enough, we are in danger of losing all of our other freedoms.
Now we leave this very spirited discussion, and I hope you'll join us again in the next episode of Free to Choose.
Want more episodes like this? Don't forget to subscribe and get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.